Today we continue the discussion we have just started about the quantum lattice. I will explain why is this ZEP two-gauge theory. This is the simplest possible quantum gauge theory on a lattice. So let's remind we have a square lattice, L by L, with periodic boundary conditions. So it's on a torus. And we have local spins 1/2 on the bonds of this lattice. Okay, so here there is C2. As you know, by C2 is the span over complex numbers of two states that we call 0 and 1. What usually this basis in quantum information is called the computational basis. Okay. And so the Hilbert space of the spins, it is what we call the total Hilbert space, is C2 tensor 2L squared.
Yes.
Because there are 2L square links on the lattice. Okay? And we know that in order to make a gauge theory, we need to introduce a gauge structure. That is, we need to define another Hilbert space that is obtained by taking the original states in the full Hilbert space and identifying some of them, like we did in the example of a particle in a circle. So we will call H gauge those states in H tot such that if you transform them with some gauge transformation, they are invariant. Okay, so you identify the transformed one with the original one. If you remember what we did with the particle on the circle, there the transformation was a TA, the translation of a length A, and you were saying, okay, the particle on the circle is described by those states, psi, such that Ti psi is equal to psi. Here we're doing the same thing. Where An is the so-called gauge transformation, which we have defined as, if you consider all the edges that come out from a site N, and you place the operator sigma x on each of these links, the product of this is what we call An. So let me define it. An is the operator, and we use this notation. First of all, you know, this is an abuse. This is the tensor product, but I want to follow the literature. Okay, so, and we say the links coming out of N, we use this notation, of sigma x at the site, at the link L. So as you can see, this transformation is local, right? Because for every N, which is a site, we have a transformation. So notice that in each thought, an is a real transformation. It associates to some state, generally another state psi prime. However, in H gauge, an psi just gives you psi. So it's what I call the transformation between the labels, remember, of the state. Very good. So we need to understand what this gauge invariant, is it called the gauge invariant or the physical Hilbert space, looks like. So in gauge theories, you usually call this one the physical Hilbert space, and the parent one is the one that only contains many other useless labels. Okay, it's not really physical. So we need to understand this. And to this end, the first thing that we would like to understand is what it looks like. Is it, for instance, the tensor product of something or not? Okay, yes.
So the structure of H gauge is now the quotient space, right?
Yeah, we're getting there in just a second.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. So I want to understand if this is still the tensor product of local Hilbert spaces. Okay. So, you know, at least mathematically, well, actually, we have to see. Okay. So how do we see that? So notice that, let's say that I have just one gauge transformation, just one local gauge transformation. So you see, I'm saying these are the states that are embedded, that are in H thought, such that they respect this constraint. Right? This is what I wrote. So H gauge is some subset of all the states in H thought, right? This is what I wrote there. So we would like to understand if this, obeying this constraint, can be understood as a projection from H thought to the new space. Okay, so let imagine that instead of H gauge, I pick one specific n, I call it n tilde, and I'm calling H tilde just this Hilbert space, the psi in H thought, such that A of a specific n tilde, so this here means for every n, psi is equal to psi. Okay, so I want to understand if I could write H tilde as some projection operator on H thought. Okay, so now I want some help from you. And do you have any suggestion what this projection operator, knowing that it has to enforce this constraint, right? Sorry, this constraint might look like. Do you have any suggestion?
It should be perpendicular to AM minus one.
True. Yeah. Okay, let's say that I propose that this projection operator is the identity plus a m tilde over 2. Okay, so this is my claim. So first of all, we need to understand whether this is a projection operator at all. So we need to check that p squared is equal to p. Is that the case? So what happens if you take the square of this operator? You get the identity plus 2 times a times the identity plus a squared. Now, what is a square?
Identity.
The identity. So you have, and underneath you have 4.
Yes.
So you have 2 times the identity plus a over 4, which is again p. Okay, so it is a projection operator. Second thing we need to check is that this projection operator, what does is really to project you on this subspace. So do we do that? So we take some generic psi in H tilde, and we project it. And now we want to check whether this is in H tilde or not, right? This is what we need to prove, that this state is in H tilde. And proving that it is in H tilde means that if I operate with A n tilde, I get, again, itself, which is p psi. You agree? OK, now this is easy to prove, because you can easily see that p and A n commute. Right? So if they commute, I can write it as p a n psi and tilde psi, right? Well, actually, I don't really need to do this. It's easier. We will use this commutation thing later. So an acting on p just gives me 1 half an plus an square. Which is the identity. So this is again p. So which proves the statement. OK. Good. OK, so we know this is a projection operator. Now, if I want to understand H gauge, for every constraint, I need to project. And the order of these projections doesn't really matter, because all these projection operators commute with each other. Because, so let me write it here. It should be obvious that for every pair n and m prime, these two operators commute. Do you see that? These are just products of different sigma x's. All the sigma x's operators do commute. Okay. So if they commute, also these projection operators for every n commute. And finally, we can write H gauge like a total projection operator on H tot, where, I don't need this, where the total projection operator is the product of every n in our lattice of Pn H tot. and let me rewrite here the definition of Pn, which is the identity plus An over 2. Now, notice that, yes?
In the proof you just erased, we showed that P times psi is in H tilde, but we haven't shown that H tilde is limited to P times psi.
Oh, okay, right. So you want to show I think that what I showed goes in both directions, right? So the other direction is actually obvious. If a state is such that An psi is equal psi, then it is by definition in H gauge, right? Okay. Okay, cool. Okay, so now we would like to understand what is the dimension of H gauge. In order to do that, we will try to find some good quantum numbers to describe this space. So to do that, we start from here. Okay. So notice that these ans are good quantum numbers because they all commute with each other. Okay, so already in this state, in this Hilbert space, I could describe my states using these as an as quantum numbers, right? And the question is, how many quantum numbers do we have here? How many are these ans? Very good. So there is a constraint for every site. So it seems that we have an, the number of ans should be 1 per site, which is L square. However, we have a little problem because not necessarily all these an operators are independent from each other. In fact, they are not. And we have a global constraint, which is the product over all the sites of an. So let's try to compute this product. Okay, so look what happens. What happens if I multiply, so these operators are also called the star operators. So so this is something that we will use a lot. So let me do it. Imagine that I take the product of these two star operators. So this means I will color a link if I'm operating with sigma x there. So I'm operating with sigma x here, and then here, and then here, and then here. Then I use this one, and I'm operating with sigma x here, 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 here. And you see that here I'm operating with the sigma x square, which is the identity. So this is equal to this object. Yes, what is your question?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask how an was defined. So what does L mean over here? Is it like...
N is the index of the site. Okay? So N is labeling the sites. How many sites do we have? L square. So there are L square ans.
When you say that it's a product of the sigma matrices, so... Yeah,
here?
Yeah.
Oh, this is your question. An is defined as the product of sigma x over all the links that belong to a certain site,
okay,
which is what I sketched here.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. So now is this clear that we get this? So let's see what happens if I take a more complicated product of adjacent star operators, for instance, 9 of them. Okay. So you see that all these spins are operated on twice. Right? Do you agree with that? Do you all see that? Whereas these outer spins are operated only once. I'm putting it in bold. So the figure that we have is just this. Do you agree? So the interior cancels. There is a convenient way of representing this thing that I could define some strings, we will use this a lot later, that run on the dual lattice. You see this loop? It's joining the centers of the plaquettes, which are the sides of the dual lattice. And then I could define this operator. So let me call this curve gamma. And I could define, in general, this operator called W gamma. And I will put X here as a reminder of what's going on. This is just the product of L in gamma, means all the links that are crossed by this gamma, of sigma x. So this is a loop of, this is in general a string operator, because gamma is a string. In the case like this one, the string is closed, this is a loop operator. So let me put it in parentheses. Loop if gamma is closed. Okay. Now that's a convenient way of representing the product of many star operators when that they are adjacent. So the product of adjacent star operators, so let me put this n in some subset I, is some gamma C. I put C means closed. Okay. What happens if these star operators are not adjacent? So for every group of those that are adjacent, you get a loop, right? So you would have, in general, this object would be something like this. And we still call this curve that is made of disconnected pieces, we still call it gamma C. So gamma C is the union of these three curves. So it's still an object that is made of loops, it's the product of loops. Right? Okay. So this is something that we will use a lot. So now let's go back to our problem that was, what happens if we take the products of all the n's, over all the n's of an? Then, as we see, the interior cancels. But if you take, remember, you have periodic boundary conditions. So we are left with only the boundary. But if you have periodic boundary conditions, what is the boundary?
You don't have boundary.
You have no boundary. We are on a torus. There is no boundary. So this product is the identity. In other words, imagine this is the lattice. When I get to the last one, this means that this spin is equal to this spin. But I have acted with both this operator and this operator. So also this and this cancel. And the same on the other side, right? So that's why it becomes the identity. Oh, but if the product of all of them is the identity, it means that for every n, for every n1, let me call it n1, then the product over all the n but n1 of an times an1 is the identity. Then I multiply on the right for an1 both sides, and so I get this. So as you can see, this means that I can always express one of these operators in terms of the others. In other words, if I define L squared minus 1 of these quantum numbers, the last one is determined, right? Because it must be given by the product of the others. So what are the possible values of these quantum numbers? So here, notice that I am being very relaxed in the notation as, depending on the context, an is either an operator or the associated quantum number. So if I want to be a stickler, I should say, always put all these things. Okay. And now this relationship holds for both the operators, but also it holds, we will see, for the eigenvalues. There was a question? No. Okay. So what are the, now this is without the hat, so these are the possible eigenvalues of this operator. What are the possible eigenvalues of such an operator? Since this operator squares to the identity, then the possible eigenvalues can be only plus 1 and minus 1. Okay. So you see that these an numbers from the algebraic point of view are spins one off. Right? It's like being in the sigma z basis of some other spin. It's not the original spins on the lattice, it's this variable an. They have two eigenvalues. Notice that also the local gauge transformations make a group which is made by An at the identity. Right? There are only two elements. There must be the identity there. Let's check that all the products work. So An times the identity is An. The identity times the identity is the identity. So I'm not getting out, right? An times An is the identity. And for every element, there is the inverse. So the inverse of the identity is the identity. And the inverse of An is indeed An, because inverse is defined by An to the minus 1 times An equal the identity. And this is satisfied when A to the minus 1 is An itself, because the square is the identity. So you see, this is the group of two elements. So it's the Z2, local gauge group. So because the local gauge transformations are Z2, that's why this is called lattice Z2 gauge theory. And you also know that there is nothing simpler than that, because there is no group that is simpler than Z2. Okay, so you know there is really nothing simpler than this that we can do. Okay. So you see that every time I fix one of these constraints, so I am fixing the eigenvalue of one of these An operators, you see, because actually what I'm saying here is equivalent to saying the eigenvalue of this operator in this state is plus one. So every time I project, I am halving the dimension of the Hilbert space, right? Because I have these two quantum numbers that are labeling my basis, and I'm excluding the minus one. I only have those with the plus one. And how many projections am I making? Now I want you to tell me. In order to get to H gauge, how many projections am I making?
L squared minus 1.
Very good. L squared minus 1. Because the last one, once I've determined, as we said, all these quantum numbers, they're all plus 1, the last one must be plus 1. So I don't need to project anymore. So these are L squared minus 1 independent projections. And therefore, my dimension goes from 2 to the 2L squared to 2 to 2 the L squared minus L squared minus 1. You agree? Every time I'm halving, so I'm dividing by 2, I'm dividing by 2 this many times, L squared, minus. L squared minus 1 times, so this is what I get. And this is equal to 2 to the L squared plus 1. This is the dimension of H gauge. So as you can see, we got a very simple algebraic calculation to understand what is the dimension of this Hilbert space. Everything is so simple because this group is abelian. And so and not only some billion, it's Z2, so there are only two eigenvalues. So it's very easy to do this computation. It can actually be done for every discrete group. But that is a more complicated story. But the logic is the same. You just have a more complicated mathematical structure that we will be exploring in part two. Okay, so before I go ahead, do you have questions on this? Is it clear why this is the dimension of H gauge? Okay, so.
Yeah, I didn't really get how you actually reduced it. Can you just go over?
Sure. So in H total, these operators are good quantum numbers, right? Because they commute. So this means that I can label the basis elements of H top, not all of them, but I can use this to start labeling the states. It's like when you do the angular momentum and you are thinking of L square, right? It's a good quantum number. So a complete basis would be L square LZ. But if this is, so both quantum numbers are labeling the states, right? And in fact, the dimension of the space is equal to the product of these values, the number of these values times the number of these values. So I know that these quantum numbers are not sufficient to label all the states in my Hilbert space, or at least have not shown that. But they definitely are good quantum numbers. These quantum numbers can have two values, plus one and minus one. Okay? So this means that each of them defines a subspace that is two-dimensional. Now I project. So I project on the subspace of eigenvalue plus one. So every time I make a projection, this subspace has a dimension that is half of the previous one. Do you agree with that?
I don't see why.
Because, okay, let me give you R2. Okay, so we have vectors in R2. So this is a bidimensional vectors. Okay, so it has components on here and on here. Now I want to project on the subspace in which this component is the total length of the vector. Okay, I have this constraint. So when I project, I have this vector. Now this vector lives in a one-dimensional space, so I halved the dimension of the space. And this is exactly what we are doing here. Only here I'm done, right? I've done one projection, I'm done. Now here we have L squared minus one projectors. They are L squared minus one because there are L squared AN operators, but one of them is not independent. Okay, so this means that starting from the initial dimension, this is the dimension of H dot. Each time I operate a projection, I divide by two. So this becomes two to the initial dimension minus the number of constraints, which is this. Make sense? Yes?
Okay, so I've seen this gauge transformation discussed as a momentum operator, and then the loops are constructed from the conjugate position operators.
Mm-hmm.
Here it looks like you're also constructing the loops from the momentum. Is that correct? Or from the electric flux?
You're absolutely correct, but in some sense, you're using a jargon, because it depends what you mean by momentum, right? So if by momentum you mean the momentum, this is not the momentum. But if you mean, which is a very legitimate use of the word, that is the conjugate operator to another operator, well then, the answer is yes. So this is an is the conjugate operator of some other operator. Okay?
Yeah.
Well, that I'm not specifying yet now.
Okay. The gauge transformations are living at the lattice points.
Yeah.
I guess the question is there anything living on the lattice edges yet?
Yeah, I'll be.
Okay.
That is a very good question. I'll get back to this question. Just give me 3 minutes, okay? We'll get there. Well, but this is an excellent question, right? So we have given a meaning to strings in the dual lattice, and you want to know if there is something equivalent that where the strings run on the links, right? Yeah. The answer is yes. I'm going to show it right away. So, okay, now that we know that this is the dimension of this Hilbert space, we need to find good quantum numbers for this Hilbert space. Right? So I want to describe a state in this Hilbert space. I need a basis. So now our next question will be, what is a basis in H gauge? So first question, can we label the states in H gauge by using the AN quantum numbers? Why you say no?
Because they all do the same thing to everything.
They're all one. They're not quantum numbers anymore, right? They're frozen. It is, I erased it, it's like trying to label the states of LZ by the eigenvalues of L square. We have already decided that all the L square operators, which are the A operators in this analogy, are one. So now we're looking for the LZ quantum numbers. Okay. So one thing that should be important, now remember what we did when we discussed the particle on a circle. These new quantum numbers that I will call B, okay, just because we have first the A quantum numbers, now we have the B quantum numbers that label the states in H gauge. They should commute with AN, with the gauge transformations. Is it clear why? So imagine they do not commute, right? So imagine that I am in a state that is in a generic superposition of states that are labeled by B. Okay? For instance, a very stupid superposition, non-superposition, just a configuration of the B quantum numbers. And now I operate with the AN on this state. Okay. So if these operators commute, then this is equal to So if I have some configuration of these B operators, okay, so if these two operators commute, this is what I want to say, A and B have common eigenvalues. Okay, they can have eigenvalues in the same basis. And this means that having decided a configuration of B does not disturb these quantum numbers. So if they were plus one now, they are plus one. If they were plus one before, they are plus one now. But if they do not commute, then when I act with B on some state, I'm changing some of the A quantum numbers. And if I'm changing some of the A quantum numbers, I'm getting out of the Gauge-Hilbert space, because the Gauge-Hilbert space is the one in which all the A quantum numbers are frozen to one. Very good. So if we want a basis in H gauge, must be given by some operators that commute with the AN. And now I get to your question. I want to show you a generic operator that commutes with AN. Okay? So, first of all, there are all the operators that are made with products of sigma x's. Okay? They do commute with AX. Unfortunately, it's very hard to understand if these are independent quantum numbers, because I just showed you that the product of sigma x sometimes is equal to the product of the A operators. So, you know, I don't know if I'm introducing new quantum numbers. It's not a good idea. But there is another thing I can do, which answers your colleague's question, which is this. Imagine that now I define new string operators, like these ones. Now, again, I want to use a closed string, but in principle, I could use an open string. Okay? Let me call this gamma again. And now I want to distinguish this type of gammas from this type of gammas. Well, this is easy because we have a convenient label, because these ones are those that will bear sigma x. So I can just call the loops on the dual lattice, or the curves on the dual lattice, I can call them gamma x. But now I want to do something different. Now you see this is a loop on the links. So let me call it gamma z. And now I can define a new operator, which is w of gamma z, which is the product over all the links that are on this path of sigma z this time. Very good. So these are the other operators that are the analogs. Okay. Now, do you see that when this is a closed loop, this will commute with every AN? Do you see that? So let's check. Okay? So, will this operator? So what is this operator? It's sigma z, sigma z, sigma z, sigma z, sigma z, sigma z. Right? This is what I said. Will this operator commute, for instance, with this star operator? Right, they don't have any link in common, so they commute with, they have nothing in common. Remember that in all our algebra, these things where I don't say what an operator looks like means it's the identity. So they commute with their where they are the identity. Notice that the star operators with respect to these curves can have either zero links in common or two. For instance, like here. It's not only true in the corners, also if I put the star operator here, you see, it will have two. A convenient graphic way of seeing this is that if this is my Z loop operator, then just a star operator can be seen as a very short loop, very small loop in the dual lattice, which looks like this. Right? Remember our notation? Flipping this. Sigma x means this loop. This is what I have there. So you see that these loops, they're loops. So they can only intersect in an even number of ways. Okay, when they intersect, they anti-commute like sigma x and sigma z, because this is what they carry. And you have already done this calculation when we did the Ising model. What happens when sigma x and sigma z anti-commute an even number of times? They commute. Okay, so this is zero. So it is true that these loops that we call Wilson loops, since these commutes, are gauge invariant quantities. So these are safe operators. In other words, if you operate with one of these operators on a state that is in H gauge, it will stay in H gauge. Yeah?
Do you get gauge invariant surfaces if you go to four dimensions or higher dimensions?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Dimensionality is not an issue.
Okay. Well, sorry, the question is, do they go from loops to actual surfaces?
That's interesting. So it depends on the dimensionality. I mean, this is a great question because this has to do something that we will talk about in part two. Okay, so in 3D, this is the star operator. And so you see that on the dual lattice, let's see if I can make it happen. Wow. Okay. It's a cube. It's the surface of a cube. And if I make the product of many star operators, this will be the surface of a closed membrane. However, the other quantity, they are still just loops. And the way it happens is that, okay, so let me try to show you a membrane that is closed. So you see, this is a three-dimensional surface. the other quantity is a loop. And again, you have that they can intersect an even number of ways. Okay, so in 2D, these two operators are dual. As you can see, a star operator becomes a plaquette operator in the dual lattice, and vice versa. They're dual to each other. In 3D, they're not dual to each other. Yeah.
This is just a issue about the graph structure. Right? I think it has absolutely nothing to do with your dimension, because as long as you got a graph, then of course for any loops you got, and for each node, you got the number of input and output line summed together to get an even number.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. So this construction can be repeated on every graph that is wrapped around a Riemann surface, which means a closed surface. So for our goals, we do need right now, then this hypothesis can be relaxed, a closed surface. Like right now, we have periodic boundary conditions. Remember, we are saying that this object is a torus. So you can repeat it on a generic Riemann surface, and there is, the Euler equation that relates the number of plaquettes and the number of sites in every graph that is embedded in a Riemann surface. And this is something like the number of the plaquettes plus the number of sites minus 2g is equal to 0, where g is the genus of the Riemann surface. So Riemann surfaces topologically are classified by their genus, which means the number of handles that they have. So you have a sphere, genus 0, you have the torus, genus 1, you have this double donut, g equal 2, and so on and so forth. And this is all you can do. But not always, does not need to happen like here, is that the number of plaquettes is exactly equal to the number of links. This is only because they're dual to each other. Yeah, sure. Okay. Generally speaking, however, when a graph is regular enough and you need that to embed it in a Riemann surface, then it always has a dimensionality. How we define the dimensionality on a graph? So what you do is that, okay, so here you have all your points in your graph lambda, so you have your links, whatever they are. Okay? And you can ask a question. Imagine I take the so-called bold of radius r. You know what it is by now, right? It means it's the set of all the links that are contained, or sorry, of all the points that are contained in a subset of your lattice such that these points are at a distance that it is at most r from a given site. So this defines the graph theoretic bold. And if the graph is regular enough, you want to count the number of points in the ball. Right? So this is the cardinality of the subset X. So this is X, the whole ball. Okay. So it's the volume of X, right? This is what we call the volume. Now, if the graph is regular enough, this number scales homogeneously around the graph as a scaling with R, which is some power law. Okay? So definitely, if you are able to embed your graph in Riemann surface, you can prove that this is the case. And even if you can't, you know, there are weaker conditions. And this D is what you call dimension. Right? So we know we are in 3D because if I am at a distance r from a point, and you see, all I need to have is some graph theoretic structure, which is much weaker than the whole manifold R3. Well, then the number of points in this ball scales like R cube. So this is called Hausdorff dimension. And the cool thing is that, you know, you don't, even if you have a fractal, you have properties like this. And that's why D can be a rational number instead of, you know, just an integer. Okay, so 1 minute and then I finish. I really want to say this. Or maybe, okay, so the Wilson loops are the gauge invariant quantities, okay? So we will try to define our basis in H gauge using Wilson loops, and then we will count. Okay, we will count if we can label actually all the basis states, and we will see it tomorrow morning.